Everybody, I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 26, 2019. Let the record reflect the time is 3:41 p.m. Today we have present Senator Reinbold, Senator Machicki, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, myself, Chair Schauer. Senator Kawasaki is sick today, might be calling in over the phone. We'll see here if he actually is online. Do you happen to know if he's not yet? Okay, he'll call in. Thanks. I'd like to remind everybody in the audience and committee members, please silence or turn off your cell phones. Staff assisting us today is Jeannie with State Records, and we've got Doug with the Leo. One main item on today's agenda, and that's going to be bringing back up Senate Bill 34, probation, parole sentences, and credits, and go over the questions and concerns about bill for members. If time allows, we're going to have the Department of Revenue online, and we're going to bring back up Senate Bills 23 and 24 dealing with the governor's payback of the permanent fund dividend. This time we're going to go ahead and bring up Senate Bill 34, probation, parole sentences, and credits, sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee on request of the governor. We have Director of the Criminal Division for the Department of Law, Mr. John Skidmore, is on the phone with us today to answer any questions, as well as representatives from the Department of Corrections and the Parole Board. So we'll go ahead and get Mr. Skidmore on the line. Mr. Skidmore, how do you hear us?
Good afternoon.
Thank you for being with us today, and if you could just go ahead and put yourself on the record, and then we'll get ready for questions here in a moment.
Of course. My name is John Skidmore, and I'm the Director for the Criminal Division, the State of Alaska Department of Law.
Thank you. And in Department of Corrections, who do we have today? Yes, ma'am. And we'll just, if we get to, if you go ahead, you can come on up, because it might just get to that, and then you're there.
My name is Jennifer Winkleman. I am the Director of Probation and Parole.
Thank you. And while we've got him, just in case it comes up, so it's on the record, Mr. Edwards, are you with us as well?
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Edwards. I'm the Director of the Parole Board.
Thank you. We'll keep it primarily on Mr. Skidmore, I believe, from that one. Okay. The intent today is to run through Senate Bill 34, and my goal is if we have any amendments from any committee members, then we're going to bring those up on Thursday, and barring any slowdowns after that or other issues we have, we'll likely try to move the bill out of committee on Thursday and get that into judiciary if we're able to do so. Mr. Skidmore, I'm going to run through some changes I have, and committee members, if you have areas of concern, questions, et cetera, just go ahead and stop at any time, bring those up. I'm going to handle this almost like a sectional and just go right down the areas that I had these questions on. So, like I said, you're welcome to jump in any time. Starting, Mr. Skidmore, if I could, with Section 4 when you're ready. On page 3 of the CS.
Is there a particular question you have for me?
There is.
Nope.
I just wanted to make sure you were there and you had it up. I don't want to throw you a page number and you're not at the right place. On the Section 4, so the H, the commissioners, what I'm looking at, question I have is that one of the concerns, I guess, is the commissioner has given power to make the regulations about probationers, and what we're looking at is maybe making a change that would allow the Department of Law, Corrections, and DPS to have to collaborate on setting this up, as opposed to having a situation in the future where we had one particular individual that would be able to make that change. So I'm asking if you would see any issues with having those three departments, law, corrections, and DPS, establishing together or working together to establish the program in H.
To the chairs. Section 4 of SB 34 deals with what are referred to as earned compliance credits, and that's really about how you manage time accounting for individuals that are committed to the Department of Corrections. The regulations that are discussed for managing the earned compliance program are therefore established by the commissioner in the Department of Corrections, because those are individuals that are within the Department of Corrections' control. The Department of Law really does not have a role over in the supervision of individuals committed to the Department of Corrections and the development of any regulations, the role the Department of Law plays is first to consult with a particular agency about any policy objectives that they want, and there are lawyers assigned to the Department of Corrections for that purpose. And then second, any regulations that are proposed by any entity within the state of Alaska also go through a regulations review by attorneys at the Department of Law to ensure that the drafting is consistent with other regulatory drafting or statutory drafting, which is a legal review that is done but is not about the specific management for those individuals. I'm unaware of any role that the Department of Public Safety plays in the supervision of individuals committed to the Department of Corrections or in any way involved in time accounting. The only role I'm aware of that the Department of Public Safety plays in relation to corrections is the transportation of inmates for court hearings.
Okay, thank you for that. Go ahead, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Just remind me on Section 4, we talked about the regulation for the earned compliance credits, but then the nothing in a subsection prohibits section, the 1255 in there, it's under this chapter and 1255. Remind me again what 1255 is, and my apologies for having asked a dumb question in public, but I need to be reminded.
There's a lot of statutes.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I would first tell you that there's never a dumb question. Second, I would tell you that Title 33 specifically focuses on the Department of Corrections. Title 12, Chapter 55, is really addressing the sentencing provisions for criminal conduct, and there are some statutes in 1255 that may address authorized conditions of probation or things of that nature, but 1255 overall is about sentencing procedures in criminal cases, sir.
And thank you. My apologies for asking. Generally, I would have had these notes, but I'm not there yet.
No, you've been busy. You're okay with that? Good. Other questions so far? Senator Machigi?
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. I don't remember if I asked this question or not, but I've been curious about in Section 4 how you arrived at a 30% credit versus a one-for-one.
Through the chair, Senator Machigi, that calculation is one that has been adopted by the federal government in recent legislation that was passed. That is also a ratio that has been found in some of the studies that were conducted on earned compliance credits. I don't have a particular rationale other than that seems to have been a common ratio that others have used, and that when we examined the ratio of 1-for-1, the conclusion was a 50% reduction seemed too great. And I wish I had something more concrete than seemed, but that's really what it comes down to, is that a 50% reduction seemed greater than what was necessary. A 30% reduction seemed appropriate. There are many other aspects of our law that look at things in thirds, whether it is discretionary parole, whether it is mandatory parole, whether, those sorts of concepts, we generally tend to look at them in thirds. And so I think that's the natural course, is to follow what is already consistently laid out in our statutory schemes about how to look at concepts of how much time should be looked at or reviewed for when there is some benefit that could potentially be associated with it.
Follow up.
So I think by this change, you're saying you support the concept that compliance should be rewarded, but you felt that one-for-one was too rich.
Through the chair, Senator Machigi, that is accurate, that the administration came to the conclusion that providing incentives that is rewards for good behavior makes sense. It flows logically from, I think, most people's experiences that if you want to change behavior or encourage behavior, there are really two ways to go about it. One is to provide a reward. The other one is to punish noncompliance. And what this particular section of SB 34 attempts to do is to provide a reward. There are certainly sanctions that are also available, but this is the one focusing on a reward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks.
And Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Cargill.
This is just for the committee discussion. I will probably look at that as an amendment only because we are changing like several structures of both the reward and the sanctions. And so horizontally, the best I can look at it in the short time frame we'll have, my thinking is what we set out was probably even sufficient now given some of the sanctions that we've changed, including those who can get access to some of these benefits. So that is just a broad statement I'm going to be – I just wanted you to know I was going to look at it.
Copy that. Going on to the next one I've got here is we continue in Section 4, and as you read for Section 4 down to Bullet 2, you've got Alpha Bravo Charlie. I have a question on that as we look in better English. Include policies and procedures for calculating and tracking credits, reducing the probationer's period of probation based on credits earned, and notifying a victim under AS 3330013. What about if a probationer violates the provisions? What would happen to their credits at that point? I don't see anything about that. It may be somewhere else, but how would that be handled?
To the chair, the penalties, if you'll give me just a moment, I'll find the right subsection for that. But the penalties that are associated with it are twofold. First, if someone were to not follow through with good behavior, then obviously they would not be awarded the credit against probation time. That is, it would not be a shortened period of probation or parole. I believe this particular provision actually deals with just probation, so let me focus just on that. Then there is another provision that also indicates that if the person does not follow through, then they lose the credits that are accrued, and that is actually Section 5, which is the very next section, also found on page 4 of the bill, where it says under J, starting at line 9,
right,
if a probationer is found in violation of the conditions of probation, the probationer forfeits any credits earned under H of this section before the date of the violation. So you have twofold. First, they wouldn't receive the credit for the given time frame, the 3-1, and then second, if there was also a violation found by the court, because this is probation, so a petition to revoke probation is assessed by the court, and if the court found that there was a violation, then that would mean that any credits that had been accumulated or accrued to that date would be lost.
Okay, and I'm going to follow that up with this as well. And there a little bit later, but I'll talk about it here. When you talk a violation, there's a difference between a violation and a technical violation, as I understand it. Could be, I may have that misinterpreted, but can you speak to that a little bit? Because obviously one of the concerns is if you have somebody that, say, for example, forgets their appointment, it's something not nefarious, they just missed it, they forgot it, but, you know, it wasn't something more serious. How is that delineated between those so we're trying to modify the bad behavior but not penalize somebody if it was something that was more of an, you know, for lack of a better term, a more innocent mistake that they made?
To the chair, the statute itself speaks of a violation, and in this context for violating probation, what we're really talking about is when that is submitted to the court. That is, a petition is filed with the court and the person is found in violation of that. There is a concept of administrative sanctions. And when the probation officer believes that somebody had not followed conditions set out, they can take administrative action but that's not imposing additional jail time. That's certainly the intent here, is that the violation for which somebody would lose accrued credits is a violation that is found by the court. If the committee is concerned about that delineation, you could certainly add language to make it clear that this is only a violation found by the court and not something that was addressed administratively.
Okay, thanks. We may actually do that. That's something we were looking at. Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, later on in the bill, under parole, section 16, you actually removed the words "other than a technical violation" under AS 33-16-215. Why was it not clarified for probation as well?
Which line was it?
Page 11.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. Technical violation is delineated in that particular section of the bill. It is not delineated earlier. The reason for the removal of the term technical violation is that the bill also eliminates the concept of placing caps for violation of what are known as technical violations, both in probation and parole. And when those are eliminated, you're simply left with a violation, not a technical or a non-technical, but simply a violation. And so referring to technical violations at that point makes it inconsistent or awkward to have two different terms being used. And so throughout the bill, it should simply be saying a violation. And that is intended to be a violation, again, found either by the courts or by the parole board, not by something that a parole or probation officer tries to address administratively.
So the follow-up is the removal in section 16, does that mean that is the intent of the discussion in probation as well?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I can tell you that that's the intent. In section 16, you remove a technical violation. When you want to talk about probation, I would refer you back to sections 1 and section 2, where you are – actually, I guess it's just in section 1 where we're talking about what happens for a probation violation. That's in Title 12. And the removal of a technical violation is eliminated there. Technical violation is found in a number of subsections throughout the bill, that particular term, and it's removed every place that it is found. The overall intent in the bill, both for probation and parole, is that when we talk about violations, those are meant to be violations that are established when found by either the court or by the parole board, such that there is due process associated with it. An offender is placed on notice of what they are accused of violating the particular condition. There is a contested hearing. They are entitled to counsel. There is a finding of fact by an independent body that then says, here is the burden of proof that was met. Yes, this particular violation is found. And then that entity is also determining the appropriate sanction to be imposed. That's what's referred to for the violations throughout the bill, either for parole or probation.
Thank you.
Just a follow-up to that, and so the one I brought up earlier about a technical violation, would that actually cause issues throughout the rest of the bill if we tried to insert it later, where we were talking about that, I believe, in Section 4?
To the chair, if you're trying to delineate between a type of conduct that violates a condition but is not a violation found by either the court or the parole board, I would recommend using something other than the term technical violation. I would instead be referring to a violation found by the court or a violation found by the parole board. That is clear that due process is associated with it and who it is that needs to find the violation, but you're moving away from the description of the type of violation that would be associated with it. Again, the difficulty in trying to delineate a technical from a non-technical, the way it's currently done in law is to say a non-technical is a new criminal offense. The problem with that has been there is a vast array of technical violations, everything from something as simple as not reporting to a probation officer on a particular day, maybe being an hour late, maybe being a day late, maybe being 30 days late. All of those would be considered a technical violation, as would the consumption of alcohol, as would being in the presence of other convicted felons, as would you go on and talk about the treatment that they haven't complied with. Anything that is not a new criminal crime, a new crime that has been committed, is deemed a technical violation. And that's a vast array of conduct, which also then has to be taken into consideration with what was the underlying offense. Someone that consumes alcohol, and in consuming alcohol, they're more likely to commit a violent offense, is very different than the person who consumes alcohol and maybe had committed a criminal trespass. It's very different for someone who is in contact with other known felons for maybe a felony DUI versus someone that is convicted of a misconduct involving controlled substances that would be dealing drugs and being around other known felons. Those are two very different scenarios, and so simply saying a technical violation completely ignores how that particular violation is associated to or related to the underlying criminal charge for which the person was convicted. That's one of the primary issues with the way that this was set up and designed.
Thank you. Senator Rambold?
Thank you. And I'm actually, I didn't know what order we were going in, so I'm going to actually jump back to section one. And my questions are based on the rights of the accused and the right to a speedy trial in the Constitution. That is Article 1, Section 11. One of the reasons SB 91 got passed was because of pretrial delays, and, you know, that always benefits the defendant. And so I'm trying to motivate the defendant to want to get to trial and rather than pretrial delays. And so in the committee substitute, page 2, line 2, I'm considering a discussion and possibly an amendment on the credit that they get earned for jail time pending a trial, just to make sure that, you know, that they're motivated to get to trial. I would like your input on that.
Through the chair, Senator Rheinbold, I want to make sure that I'm understanding the question. You're referring to SB 34, and you're talking about Section 1?
Correct. Page 2, line 2.
Give me just one moment, please.
And it's in statute already.
So in this particular provision, through the chair, Senator Rheinbold, in this particular provision of 1255-125C, this is referring to when an individual is in custody pending trial or sentencing. This is not a provision that deals with providing credit, for instance, for electronic monitoring or treatment or any other type of release. This would be where the person was actually in custody. And so if I understand your question correctly, you were looking for ways to ensure that a person does not have an incentive to delay trial, and this particular provision would not provide that because this is credit for the time that they spent in a hard bed in a facility, which is different from those others that result in incentives to delay trial because then they are getting credit towards a sentence that they might not otherwise have received. This provision, they're already in a jail facility, and there is no incentive to delay trial for that credit.
So I'm going to ask you then, what do you suggest we do? Because that was one of the reasons why SB 91 was passed, and to motivate defendants to get to trial, this area is discussing that. And is there anywhere in this piece of legislation that we can help motivate defendants to get to trial and quit doing pretrial delays so we can solve a problem that was existing before SB 91 was passed? And that's the ultimate goal.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the concepts that you describe are found in Senate Bill 33, which is another bill that is also before this committee. It's not up today, but in that particular bill, there are provisions that deal with electronic monitoring and treatment and limiting the credit that people can receive pretrial there. Those are certainly provisions that can achieve that, but in this bill, Senate Bill 34, it's predominantly focused on the conduct that occurs post-conviction, so after the sentence has been imposed, and how are we managing either probation or parole, and neither one of those really have an impact on pretrial delay. Your goal is one that the Department of Law and the administration certainly agrees with, but I believe that the appropriate place to look for that, those opportunities are in Senate Bill 33 when you deal with electronic monitoring or treatment and the credit provided pretrial for those.
Thank you.
Okay, awesome. Thanks. Let's move on to Section 5. I have a question on Section 5, Subset I. A probationer convicted of a sex offense as defined in AS 1263-100 may not be enrolled in the program established under H of this section. One of the things I'm just curious about is, was there a reason that we did not expand this to other classes of folks convicted of these crimes based on the type? So, say, a violent crime against another, you know, multiple crimes of the same offense, a serial offender type, et cetera, or the reoffenders. So it seems like it's rather narrow, and it may be addressed elsewhere, but can you describe or can you explain why we wouldn't want to make sure we're taking into account the worst offenders in this case, or maybe it's like said somewhere else?
To the chair, the concept found in Section 5 that is in subsection I of Alaska Statute 3305-0200 is really about sex offenders being on probation and not wanting to reduce the period of time that a sex offender is on probation. It is focused in that area because in our state, we manage sex offenders on probation in something referred to as the containment model. And that containment model is the way in which those individuals are supervised while on probation. That containment model has been demonstrated to be very effective in reducing the risk of reoffending for sex offenders. And so it's limited by focusing on that containment model and who that would apply to. So to answer your question in a different way, the containment model is not something utilized, for instance, for someone that commits a murder. It is not something that is designed for somebody that commits an arson. It's not designed for somebody that commits a drug distribution crime or another felony assault. It is focused on sex offenders. The question that you ask is really a different policy question, which is this particular subsection was designed to ensure that a very effective treatment model had as long as possible to be effective. But the question that you're asking is, are there certain sets of crimes for which the legislature or society at large does not believe an individual should have their period of probation reduced? That is not something that this bill has attempted to address. If that's something that the committee wanted to look at or discuss, that would certainly be an area that if you thought that should be limited, you could submit some sort of amendment or proposal for it. But this particular provision was designed to focus solely on that treatment model and ensure that an effective treatment model was not reduced in its time frame, because that could potentially reduce its effectiveness.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Cargo, go ahead.
Just on that thought, one of the things in Section 5 that I found was good and interesting was that they forfeit any credits if they violate the conditions of this. That's one of the reasons why I'll probably have try to go back to the day-for-day model, because then the disincentive becomes as significant as the incentive, in my view. So that's something that I'll be watching.
We'll ask that separately. On the same page, Mr. Skidmore, on page 4, on so section 6, subset 4, they have a lot of things that are basically, it's most of that paragraph is deleted. I have two questions. One, could you explain when you get to about halfway down, it says give receipts for money collected and make at least monthly returns of it. So that would just, if you could answer question one, what does that refer to?
Give me just one moment.
Yep, sir. No worries. It's line 28, page 4.
Through the chair, this particular paragraph is talking about administrative sanctions and records of probation work. I'm not sure exactly if that means that probationers are asked to be doing some type of work or efforts in the community, and I'm not sure what the line above it talks about, complete accounts of all money collected mm-hmm. from persons under supervision of the officer. I don't know what under what circumstances they might be collecting money from folks. I would actually encourage the committee to direct that question to Ms. Winkleman there to see if she has examples of where that may occur.
I'm looking at her right now. She's shaking her head. No idea. We couldn't figure it out either. That's why I'm asking. If you could maybe get us an answer on that, what that means. And then a generic question to whoever makes the most sense is, it seems like these things, looking at statutes, they take place anyways. You know, you keep records of work, administrative sanctions, incentives, et cetera. You go through all this. Normally that would happen regardless. So why is it deleted in this section if it kind of normally happens, or is it included somewhere else that we're not seeing, or I haven't found that, you know, where it may be cross-referenced? So why is this entire paragraph deleted? What was the reason for that? Whoever is the best person
Chair,
to answer.
This is John Skidmore for the record. The decision that was made in the drafting, both in paragraph 4 and then on page 5 for paragraph 6, they talk about this program of administrative sanctions that is more formalized or formalistic than what was being used previously. And the idea was to allow the Department of Corrections probation officers to use some sort of incentive as they deemed appropriate, but this eliminating a formal concept of administrative sanctions was saying you're not required to use administrative sanctions earlier. Let me give you an example, and I'll defer to Ms. Winkleman on this as well if I get any of this information incorrect. But for example, we know that under SB 91, there were approximately between 500 and 700 petitions to revoke probation that were filed each month since January of 2017. And if you take that and multiply it out over the whole time frame, you get approximately 14,000 petitions that are filed. Well, when you look at the administrative sanctions, we know that there was over 21,000 administrative sanctions during roughly the same time span. And so the idea is that, yes, administrative sanctions may have a place, but the way in which it is listed here in statute and, in fact, now, the administrative sanctions happen far more frequently than you are having a petition to revoke probation. And it makes it difficult to compare the pre-SB 91 to what happens in SB 91, because if you simply were, for instance, were to say that the number of petitions filed are reduced, you've completely ignored those 21,000 administrative sanctions that were imposed. So the concept here was that the way it's written in statute is more robust than what is necessary, which is why those references in the statutes are eliminated, and it's left to the discretion of the Department of Corrections as to where it's appropriate to utilize those.
DOC, do you have any follow-up on that?
This is Jen Winkleman, Director of Probation Parole, for the record. To the chair, I concur with what Mr. Skidmore said, and the idea is that this SB 34 is giving back the discretion to the probation officers to be able to essentially react to a violation based on a person's risk needs and not being bound by something in statute.
Okay, so you don't see an unintended consequence as far as taking this away, and it's going to limit their ability to do that by removing this language out of the bill?
To the chair, no.
Okay. Anybody else?
You know, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Coghill.
I'm just going to say that's a policy call, mainly because what we are trying to do is we're trying to set up a series of administrative actions that would allow people to work, to be productive. Because at this point, what we are going to do is require them to start paying people back. And so this was to allow people that freedom under this. And so I was going to go and see we're taking the section out of 3305.020G, and I'm going to look it up and make sure that that's the operative part. But I'm going back in memory, and I'm going off the cuff here a little bit, but that was the intention of the sanctions. Remember, we're turning this thing very, very differently on. We had requirements for them. We had requirements for the parole and probation board to do things, but we also equally had requirements for those under probation parole to stand up and do some work. So that was kind of the policy call in here, and I'll try to dust off my brain a little better than that.
All right, well, excuse me, move on to section 7. So, Mr. Skidmore, that's going to be page 5, and on line 28, looking for why we don't define temporary, and hold on, I'll get back. I have another note here, sorry. We just have temporary, and the reason I ask is we were given some examples of where temporary ended up being a lot longer than most people would assume temporary, like potentially years talking to certain parole officers. So is there a reason why we did not define what temporary is, and should we put a limit on that? And in addition to that, if we have greater than 75, should we go ahead and notify the victims in the court so that they're aware of, say, one example was given, a PO is fired, lose their job, and all of a sudden the caseload explodes. Should we go ahead and add that in to make sure that both the courts are aware, as well as victims, that you know, those caseload officers are getting overwhelmed during that time? Anyone?
To the chair, this is John Skidmore. I apologize. I understood you to be asking me about Section 7 on page 5. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's yeah, that's right. It's in Section 7, sub B, and then goes down where it says A4, A5. It's that next sentence, line 28. You see the word temporary, except in temporary or extraordinary circumstances?
I apologize, sir. The bill that I'm looking at on page 5 has Section 7 starting on line 24, and I don't see the word temporary. This is dealing with a probationer applying for discretionary parole, so I'm not sure what you're asking.
Do you have the CS version we're working on? I assume you do.
No,
oh, he's thinking
there. Looking at the CS
maybe.
Version.
So, okay, that would explain it then, potentially. All right, well, perhaps DOC can answer because she's here. She knows what we're talking about.
So this is Jen Winkleman, for the record. To the chair, you know, I guess maybe to give an example of a temporary situation would maybe be of some assistance. In some of our rural areas, we have probation officers that have one probation officer assigned to a unit. So let's just use Kotzebue as an example. I have one probation officer assigned out in Kotzebue. And from time to time, not only are they supervising a caseload of felons, but they also will be writing pre-sentence reports on folks that are going to come into the system for a short period of time. We write a pre-sentence report to produce for the court, and then they are sentenced based on that and go into custody. So they're on that caseload for a temporary amount of time. And that's where I could see where temporary could come into it. I could see some staffing issues and things like that that you mentioned with regard to it. I don't know if we want to look at defining, and that would be a policy call, on whether or not we define temporary out a little clearer. Or your second question about should we notify victims in court and things like that, and that would be a policy call. I'm not certain on that part. But I do understand where the temporary would come in, and I see it just from supervising rural offices.
Okay, thanks. Senator Cockill. So,
what is the average caseload right now?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I would say I didn't look this morning at what the average caseload is, but I think as a result of 91, we have seen the caseloads. It depends on the area and it depends on staffing levels, but I would think around between maybe 50 and 60.
So the next question, and while the chairman is busy, the next question is, under this, another bill, we're going to give new duties. And so is this limitation going to create temporary and extraordinary circumstances under pretrial? And so just kind of think about that, because we're putting a cap on it here, but we're giving them new duties in another bill. So I'm just, you know, something we need to think about.
So through the chair to Senator Coghill, that is certainly something we have been thinking about in regards to 33 and the pretrial functions and their caseloads as well.
It's going to create a roadblock for me, that's all.
Okay. I'm going to move on to Section 10. I have a question on Section 10B3B2I. As we go through that one, and I'll give you a chance to catch up. The prisoner would not constitute a danger to the public. And I'm just curious if we want to define that. You could say, or victim if releasing the poll released on parole. The reason I ask that question is the cases where we've had where sometimes victims are not notified. So, and I know that's become an issue. So I'm asking specifically, is that one we should define slightly further with fidelity so that we ensure that, and I'll make sure, because I see, Jen, you've got your, looking like you're questioning that one. Like, where is it? Did you find it? Page 8. Try that if you're on the CS. Page 8, line 6. When you catch up, let me know. Staff to the rescue.
So to the chair, what is your question with
question
regard?
Is,
I do have it here.
You got it. No, just make sure. I know we're jumping around quite a bit. So on that particular one, because we've had issues and some concerns of victims not being notified in this particular case, I'm asking, would it be wise to define it further that the prisoner would not constitute a danger to the public or victim if released on parole, and or within that question, ensuring that they get notified if we need to add that in somewhere else or somehow? And I ask that, like I said, just based on the fact that we've had cases of them not getting that notice and being clearly and rightfully rather upset.
So to the chair, I think right off the top, adding victim in there would be perfectly sufficient. I guess I sort of wonder if, because this is a parole matter, I wonder if Mr. Edwards is on the line and had anything to add to it, but I think notifying the victim and adding it in there is certainly doable by the Department of Corrections.
Okay, I guess in generically expanding that a little bit, is there something we're missing, and it may be in a different place, and I grant that, but just that generic thought of, are we making sure that we have the mechanisms in place so the victims are notified when things happen, parole, probation, you name it, because that's happened, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen. So we can defer to Mr. Edwards if he wants to jump on that as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Jeff Edwards, Director of the Parole Board. The department does have strict policy, and actually it's a fairly new policy about victim notification requirements, and that's specifically related to parole notifications. I do hear your comments, and they're well taken as far as adding that in there specifically into the section of the statute, and that would just be a policy decision.
Okay, and do you foresee either, actually any of you, are there any holes that we need to address while we're going through this, trying to get these right? That, and if there are, I'm asking for that information that to make sure that loopholes or places where we're missing that, that it might need to be placed to ensure we do that, need to take place. So if anybody's aware of them, I'm asking the question. You can certainly get back to me, but I'd like to make sure that that is addressed and we don't miss that this time around.
So to the chair, I can say that as Mr. Edwards alluded to, is that we do have a very robust victim notification policy, and it is relatively new. SB 91 drove it on getting our new victim policy accomplished. That being said, I think that, you know, it is certainly something that this administration, we can definitely take a look at and make sure, but I am not aware at this time of any loopholes. Okay. I think that we did a good job of ensuring that victims were notified.
Fair enough. You're the experts. That's why I'm asking to make sure we're not missing it because of those stories that have come up. And that's where we take the good and the bad from everything, right? Try to get the right blend. Senator Michicki had a question. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that subject, I wanted to remind the committee that discretionary parole under Senate Bill 34 is removing serious crimes from discretionary parole that were allowed under 91. So we're back to crimes that were previously ineligible before the passage of 91, and that is non-sex class A felonies, robbery one, assault one, arson one, B felonies if the person had one or more prior felony convictions, C felonies if the person had two or more prior felony convictions, and B and C sex felonies, sexual assault 2, sexual abuse of a minor 2, distribution of child pornography. So it looks like we essentially eliminated the victim-rich crimes from being capable of being considered for discretionary parole.
Copy that. Thanks. Like I said, just making sure we're not missing something so it's on the record. Yeah, thank you. A little bit further down on line 16, same page, on subset 5, to a single sentence under any other provision of law may not be released on discretionary parole until the prisoner has served at least one-fourth of the active term of imprisonment. And I just have a generic question. Why did we pick one-fourth? Why not one-third or one-half? In other words, are we being, and I hate to say it this way, well, I'm going to say it, are we being too light? In other words, where did that data come from? What drove the decision to go to that level versus something else? Whoever. Anyone? Bueller? As the saying goes with the movie, sorry.
To the chair, I can say that I believe one-fourth was what was pre-SB 91, and Mr. Edwards may be able to talk to the specific of where the one-fourth came from, or even maybe Mr. Skidmore.
Gentlemen, either one of you are welcome to jump on. I think Senator Rimbaud had a follow-up on that.
Mr. Chairman, Jeff Edwards again with the Parole Board. I don't have that information. It's the way it's been since I've been around, which is almost 20 years, so I would err in trying to guess where the one-fourth came from.
Mr. Skidmore, you have anything to add?
To the chair, this is John Skidmore. The two things I would say are that first, the one-fourth has been in statute for some time. Like Mr. Edwards, I don't know how that particular number was originally chosen. And then second, to your previous question about victim notification, Alaska Statute 33-30-013, subsection A, requires notification for victims when an individual is discharged from parole, and that was something that was just added in 2017. So any indications that you have or any stories that you've heard of where that hasn't occurred, I would just encourage you to verify whether that's something that has occurred since that law took effect or if that's something that predates it, because that was a change in law in 2017.
Fair point, and I appreciate you saying that. Like I said, this is more making sure that there's holes. If we're missing them, let's get it right now. We've got a chance to do it better, potentially, so that's the goal. Senator Rimbaud?
And I had that exact same question on page 8, line 16, the one-quarter active term of imprisonment, you know, if it's only served, you know, one-fourth. And what other states do that? Is this, you know, softer than a lot of other states? Is this... in average, but one quarter just seems really low to me.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, this is John Skidmore. I apologize. I do not know what other states use in that regard, so I can't give you a comparison between one state and another. I can only tell you that that's what's been in our statutes for as long as I've been practicing in the state, which is 20-plus years.
Follow up.
Go ahead. Follow up, Senator Rumble.
Can you please get that information of this one quarter of are we the only state that does discretionary parole, or is this a common thread, and is one-fourth standard? I would appreciate a comparison. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Skidmore, and I know that there is a similar law that's been passed at the federal level, so I know that's one thing you're looking at to make sure that whatever we do here is not going to run into a problem with that as far as anything with federal supremacy. So, Senator Machicki, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Skidmore, back on what I brought up about eliminating certain crimes that are available for discretionary parole. What crimes are remaining what types of crimes are remaining for discretionary parole that might help us on the one quarter consideration?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, give me just one moment. Let me turn back to the appropriate subsection. You have listed the types of crimes for which it would no longer be eligible, and I agree with that description of what's there. So the things that I think of that would still be eligible would be theft cases, damage to property cases. There's a whole series of other types of crimes, but those are the sort of the larger concepts. The robbery, the assault, the arson, those are all in Title 11, Chapter 41, which is what we consider – I'm sorry, the robbery and assault are Title 11, Chapter 41, which is what we consider person crimes. Arson is, believe it or not, classified as a property crime, but given the serious nature and the harm to others, it is included here. But the thefts, the criminal mischiefs, those are the sorts of things that immediately come to my mind. You have an escape one and a misconduct involving weapons in the first that are not eligible for discretionary parole, but lower levels of escape, lower levels of misconduct involving weapons. This would leave most of the drug trafficking offenses eligible for discretionary parole. And, of course, you also have to keep in mind the limitation for repeat offenders so that this is predominantly also focused on the first-time felony offenders, not repeat felony offenders. So it would be a first-time property offender is the generic description that I might provide to it.
Follow-up?
So follow-up, what I heard you say is that I'm rather focused on drug trafficking of first-time even relatively serious drug trafficking offender would still be eligible for discretionary parole?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, under the way the statute is drafted, that is correct. Those individuals would be eligible for discretionary parole. It is the property and drug offenses that are not included in the statute as it's drafted currently. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a...
Go ahead.
I would like to make a request of having some detail on what those drug trafficking crimes might look like if we wanted to include them in crimes that are not eligible for discretionary parole. Just if you can provide them to the chair for us to consider.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I understand the request, and we'll do our best to provide that to the chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Hold on. Senator Ramel, is that good as well, that request on discretionary?
Through the chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and Mr. Skidmore, I didn't get an affirmative or not from you in regards to whether you were willing to look into discretionary parole if Alaska was standalone in this or was this common practice, and what the standard was in other states, whether we're below or above standard. Let's just say on, 10 or 15 different states that are comparable to ours.
Mr. Skidmore, it sounds like a couple of consistent questions from a couple of committee members. Can you have your staff or whoever's appropriate maybe run that down for us and get that back to us, please?
Through the chair, to Senator Reinbold and to the chair, we can try and look for that information. It's not as easy to find other states' laws as it is to provide a description of what our own laws are, but we will certainly make the effort to do so. I don't know how easy that will be to do.
Understood. If you can just let us know how that's going, and then we have a question from Senator Coghill.
So on discretionary parole, since we're going back, we increased the number of offenders who are able to get discretionary parole. Probably what I'll need to know is how many people had been eligible under old law that will not be eligible under the new law, and how many were failures at whatever level. I think the why do we do this, as we went into it, we were incentivizing a lot of behavior. We've changed that behavior modification. I want to see if that behavior was just unworkable. And so those who are on this discretionary parole, how many failures, what were the failures on?
Mr. Skidmore, did you get that as well? Or whoever.
Chair, I understand the request. That's less of a legal research and more of a what can we determine from the tracking that's done at this point, and the administration will certainly work on that with all the departments to see what we can come up for it. I don't know what data is available for it, but we will look into it.
Okay, thank you. Moving on. Senator Baczycki.
I just want to ask a question, Mr. Skidmore. This is a total repeal of Senate Bill 91 on discretionary parole, it looks like to me. Is that correct?
It looks like so.
Through the chair, Senator Baczycki, I would need to review all of 91 to see if there are sections that are not changed by discretionary parole, but the primary components that I think of that were impacted by parole, that were impacted by 91 for parole are repealed in this particular bill. But to tell you 100%, I would need to go back and thoroughly look at all of that to see if I think there's anything that isn't touched. Here's the one thing that's jumping out at me is geriatric parole. I don't think we've changed anything on that. But when I go back and look at the things that 91 did, the administrative parole has already been revoked. Discretionary parole, who's eligible, is repealed here. The factors, those are repealed. The eligibility for it, that is repealed. The early termination of parole for recommendation is repealed. The earned compliance credits is not a 100% repeal. It changes it from 30 to 30 to 1 to 3. We've discussed that. The sanctions that can be imposed for parole violations, the good time calculations, all of those things are repealed. So I can't tell you that it's 100%, but my quick review of it suggests that we're somewhere around 95% of it.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to move on to page 13, and it's line 5. So this is section 21, subset G3. There is a, I'll just read it real quick, data on the population of the Department of Corrections using a one-day snapshot on the first day of the first month of each quarter, broken down by type of admission, offense type, and risk level. We were trying to find a definition of risk level and what that meant. Does anybody have that data? Can it be provided?
This is John Skidmore. I'm going to defer to the Department of Corrections. This is an analysis that they do of the risk level of the people that are admitted, and it has to do with then how they place them within the Department of Corrections. But how they define risk level and what the various categories are, I'm afraid I don't know.
Ms. Winkleman, you're up.
So to the chair, the risk level, we do a risk needs assessment on all offenders that come into the system. There is a classification risk level that is done to determine where they're going to be housed when they're in the facility, but there's also a risk needs done on supervision, and that's what drives our policies for how often we see them, how often we see them in the field, and it is there's a risk level attached that is done through an assessment essentially by a probation officer. There's a risk level attached to every inmate in our system or every offender in our system.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cargo, go ahead.
This is a reporting mechanism, and what we're trying to do is figure out how many people have come and gone, what were the issues. So This takes the one-day snapshot, and we've actually given them risk level requirements that are now being repealed. So, I mean, we're changing the pretrial and some of the probation issues. And so it'll be interesting to me to see how that all fits into it. This is all probation parole, but it's a Department of Corrections that's supposed to report these things on these different outcomes, on pretrial, on probation and parole. And, for example, they're deleting the requirement to take the pre-case and post-case resolution on the probationers and parolees admitted solely for technical violations. So we're saying we don't want to know that. Well, I don't know. Maybe there's, because of technical violation changes in here, I don't know what all that's going to mean. But this is a report so that we will have information based on what they've been doing. So as I've looked at this section, I'm not 100% sure that we're helping ourselves. That's all.
DOC, can you answer that in the sense of, is that something that is actually, will that prevent you from doing that? I'm kind of trying to ask what Senator Caldwell is asking. Will that prevent you from doing it, a policy thing? Can you do it on your own anyways? In other words, with the change in the law, what would that drive you to do, reference your reporting?
So to the chair, to the chair and to Senator Coghill, the risk level will still be in place for any inmate in our facility as well as an offender on supervision, probation, or parole. We did it pre-SB 91, a risk level, and we'll continue to do it post, is my understanding. The pretrial risk assessment is different, and that was what was a risk assessment that was given to the courts to determine whether they were going to be released. So that part is the part that is part of 33 that we're looking at taking out. But the risk assessment here, or the risk level here, was attached prior to 91, and again, will continue. That's what drives how we supervise, how we house folks in custody. The pretrial part is what has been recommended to be repealed in 33.
Okay. Thank you. And I believe Senator Rainbow had a question.
I do. And I apologize. I don't have all of my cross references here, so I just need a little bit of clarification on page 12, line 21, section 21. It says the DOC will report quarterly to the working group authorized in B3 of this section, and then it lists a whole bunch of information that you is this the criminal justice working group?
So through the chair to Senator Reinbold, yes. My understanding is the working group is the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, and we are providing them this information.
Okay, through the chair.
Go ahead, Senator Reinbold.
So it's you provide that. I know there's the Criminal Justice Commission and the Criminal Justice Working Group Commission, because I missed one of the meetings because they were both on alternate days. One was on a Thursday and one was on a Friday. I didn't realize that they weren't going to be meeting together, but is this available to the legislators? I mean, can we see this? Because I know Senator Costello continues to ask and not get certain data on arrests. And she's probably talked to me half a dozen times about this. And we want to know, you know, where the data is and if this kind of information is available. I wish she was here right now to ask her question. I see you behind you shaking your head and through the chair. She knows exactly what I'm asking.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and come on up and put yourself on the record.
Hi, Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner for DOC. Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I actually have been to the Senator's office and explained the particular data that she's requested is actually protected by CJIS. So it is not data that we can offer. It was given to the working group under an agreement. I mean, it actually went to the university under an agreement, so it's protected. We do want to work with you. We want to figure out when there is data we can share. We will. Just that particular data. And that has been shared with her, just so you're clear. It's just protected data due to the information in it.
Follow up?
Yes. I just think it's really important. We just had the uniform crime statistics before us, and we're told that we're not going to get the 2018 data till July of 2019, which doesn't help us during session. So if there's any type of data, even if it's raw data or preliminary data on crimes or arrests or, you know, what's the pulse is, because we keep being told, oh, the people don't know what they're talking about. You got to wait for the Pew massage data. We want to see the real data. Because the people out there are suffering, and they're suffering immensely at unprecedented levels in the state. And so we need some sort of a vector in regards to you know, any data that we can use to show that, yeah, crime is still a very, very serious issue, even in 2018.
Through the chair, Senator Reimold, we agree. And let me look at it. Let me see if there's anything I can get you that would be helpful. Absolutely. We understand that this is what the committee wants. They want to see numbers and data. And let me go back and see what I can find for you and see if there's anything that we can help.
Your final one, yeah, because it certainly seems like if this working group should get it, we as legislators should have privy to this information, even if they have to, you know, eliminate names or whatever they have to do. But if it is public data, public information, you know, there's some rules there too. So, all right.
Through the chair, absolutely. If it's public information, you all should have it as well, and I'll be glad to research that and get back to you. Absolutely.
And numbers, obviously, I echo that sentiment. We need information if we're going to make good decisions. We need metrics and data to show us which direction we go. Crime up, crime down, recidivism up, recidivism down. How do we know? And if, you know, so. Okay, thank you for coming up. That's good. Appreciate that. I have nothing else that I'm looking at for this particular bill for today. So does anybody else have anything they would like to bring up before we sit on this one for a few days? Senator Michicki.
Do you have, could you repeat your schedule for amendments?
I'm going to do that here momentarily.
Oh, okay, very good, thank you.
No worries. Anyone else? Okay. Seeing no other questions from the committee members, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. As a reminder to the committee members, including hopefully Senator Kawasaki, but we have informed him, his staff, amendments for this bill, we'd like to get them by 5 p.m. tomorrow, with the expectation I'd like to take these amendments up on Thursday. If we feel we're ready to do that, and then try to go through the discussion on those and potentially, if we can, move it out of committee to judiciary on Thursday. So we'll kind of play that by ear and see how we do. We have closed that one up here. What I'm going to do here for a few minutes, now that we're going to go ahead and set SB 34 aside, is we have the commissioner, I believe, still is Commissioner getting a finger wave. Seeing the committee has some time, a little bit here, we're going to go ahead and bring up Senate Bill 23 and 24, because they've been sitting in the queue for a while after we introduced them. I see a smiling face that is going to help us out. And Senate Bill 23 and 24, without naming them, go ahead and do it. Appropriation Supplemental Payments of Prior Year's PFD and Senate Bill 24, PFD Supplemental Payments. Sponsored by the Senate Rules Committee on the request of the governor. This is the second time we've had a hearing on these bills. We first heard them on February 5th, so like I said, it's been a month. I'm going to go ahead and ask Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Mr. Bruce Tangeman, if he'd go ahead and come to the table, and anybody else he needs to bring with him, if he chooses. Jake, were you able to get this to everybody else? They had a copy? Copy that. Okay. As they're getting ready to answer, the committee members should have this in front of them. A recent report dated today that has some anticipated or some information on the these bills specifically relating to the permanent fund and the dividend. All right, gentlemen, if you could please state your name and title for the record, and you can begin your somebody else to begin your testimony. And the big thing we're looking for here, if we could, Commissioner, is a refresher on these to kind of get us back up to speed on these bills, and then we'll go over the new information. The intent today being to get the committee members spun back up, because I'm going to ask for any amendments or changes over the next week or so we can try to get public testimony and be prepared to move these bills once we're able to accomplish that. So at this time, if you would, go ahead and please put all of yourselves on the record and begin with testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Through the chair, Bill Milks, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, Ed King, Chief Economist, State of Alaska.
Thank you.
So I'll give a quick two-minute refresher on what the two bills are, SB 23 and SB 24. They're being referred to as the back pay PFD bills. The purpose is to make whole the dividend amounts from FY16, FY17, and FY18. The governor's bills propose to pay out those amounts over the next 3 years. He viewed it as a three-year issue that has a three-year solution that we're presenting. So instead of drawing the full amount down from the earnings reserve to pay back the amount, which we're estimating it be around $1.9 to $2 billion total, we're proposing that is paid out over the next 3 years. The simple mechanics are, if you received a dividend in FY16 and you qualify in FY19, you would get that delta added to your dividend of about $1,000. $1,061. If you received a dividend in FY17 and you qualify in the FY21 period, you would get an additional $1,289 added to your dividend. And if you received a dividend in FY18 and qualify in FY22, you would receive $1,388 added to your dividend. So the justification again is, while the dividends were not paid out in full over the past 3 years, the balance of those dividend amounts did sit in the earnings reserve. We actually saw a 10% return 1 year, 12% return in another year. So they earned some healthy revenues off of the money that did sit there. But Governor Dunleavy does believe that that money is owed to the citizens of Alaska who qualified for a dividend. So by allowing it to also sit in the earnings reserve over the next 3 years and dole it out that way, we think it's a good opportunity to earn even more revenue to defer the total cost of about $2 billion.
Okay.
I think at the last presentation, we had several questions that we have now presented to you this afternoon. We could walk through those if you choose, or we could proceed however you would like, sir.
Two things. I'd like to, we don't have to, we've got about 10, 12 minutes left. Since this is new information, if you could just kind of give us the 30,000-foot view and kind of go over that. And then I'm going to open it up to questions, and they can certainly ask them as we go through the presentation. But I want to get everybody again, this is more of a get us back up to speed, the latest numbers, any changes, and then let committee members chew on it for a little bit, because we're going to be bringing these back up soon, and plus the public testimony, to try to get these as well moving so they're not sitting in committee.
Yes, sir. I'd like to turn it over to Ed King to walk through the he was the architect of the answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King. So one of the first questions that was asked was with regard to how the actual mechanics of the changing in the fund would play out. And so I put together this table here on the front page that basically is a transaction report out of the account for the transfers out of the earnings reserve and also the transfers into the earnings reserve as money is as earnings are had and realized. And so what you can see in the left-hand column, the status quo, that's without the bill being passed, on the right-hand column with the bill being passed, and you can see the impacts, the financial impacts of the account. Just trying to illustrate the fact that although there is $2 billion that's being drawn out of the account in addition to the POMB, there are also income that is being entered into the funds. So it's just to avoid any confusion if someone were to think that spending money out of the account for the next, there isn't to address the issue of whether or not there's enough money in the account to fund both general fund obligations and this proposed payback.
And may I make a comment on that to make this crystal clear, because we went around and around this the last time we brought this up. This would be akin for people at home to think this. So you have $20,000, call it that, in your account, and you spend, in this particular case, you add $4,100 to that, so you've got $24,100. You take this money back out for the dividend, and you're back at a little under $20,000. So the point being, where there was a lot of confusion, is that you're not just taking several billion dollars out of it, and so you're not at $16 billion or $16,000 left in your account. You're actually close to where you started, because you're adding income into it, you're taking income out, and you're close to being a wash. Is that an accurate way to put that into the appropriate numbers?
Yes, that's an accurate way, sir.
Okay, thank you. I just want to keep us from going too far down the spin we did last time. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed King again. The question continues on page 2 with regard to how the account balances change over time. And so I've shown on a stacked bar chart here the three different parts of the fund, the principal account, the earnings reserve account, which is a holding account for the earnings. And then there is the green portion of that bar being the unrealized account. That is just appreciation on assets that are held by the fund but that are not sold yet, so you can't actually spend the money. It's like equity in your house, if you will. That equity doesn't sit in your checking account until you sell your house. So that's what that is. Just showing here, Mr. Chairman, that the in either case, with or without this bill, the fund is projected to grow and projected to remain healthy. And it should not be confused as we turn to the next page when the ERA balance is projected to decline. That should not be confused with the idea that the entire fund is somehow in jeopardy.
Questions so far? Senator Amble.
Well, I guess it just it's hard for me just to imagine that this there's just going to be growth. You know, everything is just like a lot of these are investments that are pretty risky. And to just, I don't want a Pollyanna view. I want an honest review of this. But it's just, this is kind of, you're going to have your cake and you're going to eat it too type thinking. I mean, when I look at this chart.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, that is a good, healthy concern to have. But if you recall that both the dividend calculation and the POMB calculation is not based on a one-year amount. It's on a five-year rolling average. So that... The reason why we used 5 years was to absorb corrections in the market. So while we're not projecting a correction in the market, the assumptions by the permanent fund themselves account for things like that. So it's part of their 6.55% return that they're estimating is that it's not going to be all rosy. It's not going to be all up, you know, a nice, sweet, increasing amount. There are going to be market corrections. And that's why we've used five-year averages for both the POMB calculation and the permanent fund dividend.
Before we go to the follow-up, I think it's interesting on page three, although I'm skipping, well, I'm not really skipping ahead, but you show, which I think people would understand with SB 23, where you've taken some money out of it, even though there's money going into it, that it continues to decline. So the red bar kind of makes sense if you give the payback. Mm-hmm. However, you also show the blue bar, if you weren't to take the money out of the earnings reserve, it also goes down. What drives that? It seems to be like it'd be the opposite, like you should be seeing an increase.
So, Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, this is Ed King. and this is why I put these other charts on page two, to show there's a difference between the entire fund balance versus just the earnings reserve account balance. And what you're seeing here is that the way that the mechanisms currently work with the POMV and with the inflation proofing and the projections from the permanent fund, there isn't enough earnings to satisfy all of the requirements. And so the fund balance is declining, the earnings reserve account balance is declining, even in the status quo. You can go to the Permanent Fund Corporation website and see this. But why that, the reason that that's happening is because the principal account is growing. And so it's not as though the money is being, you know, evaporated somehow. It's just migrating to the other account. The reason why, Mr. Chairman, the red bar declines more quickly is because when you have the smaller asset base and you have the smaller earnings, the inflation proofing balance doesn't change because the principal account is the principal account regardless. So your inflation proofing requirement doesn't change, but your POMV number does. And so the entire balance of the account changes along with the dynamics that are going on there.
And for the public as well, remember fighter pilot code for explain to me? I'm just kidding. Can you explain how that money, when we're talking the difference between the ERA to the principal balance, how that is reinvested or how that ends up back in, so you can describe for folks at home why you see that blue bar increasing? You just did a really good explanation on the earnings reserve account itself, but explain the same thing in the process for the permanent fund for the principal or the corpus itself.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the principal account of the fund is protected by the Constitution, and it receives deposits of 25% or more of all of the royalties that the state collects is deposited into that principal account. All of the earnings on that principal account flow into a holding account called the earnings reserve. When the legislature decides that they want to protect some of those earnings, they move the money into the principal account in order to protect that money from future appropriations. The statute that's on the book today requires a transfer of that kind to account for inflation proofing. So the principal account increases both on the merits of the royalties that are collected and on the inflation proofing that is reappropriated into the account. And historically, when the earnings reserve account has had additional funds in it, the legislatures of the past have also done special appropriations to protect, to move that money to the principal account as well.
Thank you. I just wanted to complete the loop, the entire part, so we got it. And was there a follow-up? I think there was.
No, I just have a question.
Senator Machicki.
So I hear what you're saying on assuming the 6.55% total return and a 6.4% statutory return, but did you inject a 2008 into your modeling, on which would take quite some time to recover from, especially in the earnings reserve, where we got down to very close to zero, uncomfortably close to zero? Because that growth over time would be, especially if you continue to inflation protect, it seems like I don't feel like I see that in here.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, yes. You're right, it isn't in here, because what this is portraying is the average return that the Permanent Fund Corporation is using to demonstrate the fund. As we're doing our Monte Carlo simulations, you can look at specific iterations in which you do have these corrections. They happen once every 10 or so years, where you have a 2008 type of correction. And then you have years where you have 20% growth. And so when you have, you know, negative 18% in one year and plus 22% in another year, and you have all of this volatility, what the fund is saying in their projection is that over time it washes out to this 6.5% kind of return. Now, I would be happy to show you, hopefully in maybe in the Senate Finance Committee, some of those iterations that show, you know, how that volatility plays out. And you'll see that in some situations the permanent fund only grows with inflation, and in other situations the fund grows to over $100 billion. And we don't know which world we're going to be living in, so we have to kind of make a guess and play to those averages.
Well, so I understand. I have a little investment account myself, and I've been through the worst of the worst and the best of the best over 40 years, so I get that, and I'll look forward to that. It's very – every committee that deals with Senate Bill 23 and Senate Bill 24 becomes a finance committee. There's really no other way to look at it, right? Normally we're just policy-related, but it's very difficult in this case. Could you provide these same charts, which I know you have them. I know it's not much effort for you, but we're a little bit more granularity. So because of this looks the same – but they're not. So I would just appreciate that.
We'll be prepared when we come the next time. If you want to go ahead and break those down further, like I said, it's fine. We're going to treat this a little bit like finance, even though we're looking at the constitutional side of things here. So it's okay. Senator Ramble.
And thank you. I was thinking identical what Senator McChiggy was. You know, when we first started this questioning back and forth, that it's almost impossible to tell. They both look Pollyanna. We're going to spend a lot of money and we're going to grow, and there's never going to be a dip. It just, that's what it looks like to me. And so I think absolutely getting down into granular, and this is a 20-year projection, and what I've heard with statistics over and over again, with each year it gets less likely to happen. So I think the granular data also, you said this is the average return that the corporation is using. I want to know, is it based on statistically what has happened in the past, including 2008, and you said you're going to have to guess and play to averages. I mean, what formula are you using to guess? I'm sorry, that just doesn't look sound scientific to me.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. So the corporation uses what they call a geometric mean, which is the average of all of the future returns that they're projecting, and they use a consultant in order to generate those returns. If you actually look at the history of the funds, including the 2008 corrections, including the bad years in the early 2000s, they get overwhelmed by the really good year. We had a 10.74% return last year. We had 22% return years in some years. And so when you actually look at the 40 years of fund history, the average of the fund is over 9% return. And they're looking forward at a 6.5% return. And so the fund corporation is actually, you know, they're providing a number that is a lot more conservative than their historic performance would suggest, but they probably have really good reasons why they're doing that. It is really important, though, that because of the way that interest works just generally, that, you know, a 10% return and a 10% loss are not equivalents because of the way that the compounding works. that arithmetic mean is also really important, which we can talk about at length if you like. But what the corporation is using, this 6.5% geometric mean that they're referring to, actually works out to about a 7.65% arithmetic mean. So when we're running the simulations, we actually end up with situations where you have better returns that more closely relate to what historic performance looks like, and then you have these occasional corrections. Although the numbers that the corporation is using, the standard deviation is really quite wide, so we're trying to pin down on, you know, whether or not that distribution makes the most sense for running these scenarios or not.
We're running ourselves out of time, so I'm going to beg off if we could here. If there's top level and the less, if you want to give me the you know, Reader's Digest version real quick. So if there's anything else that you want to really highlight, let's do that real fast, and then we can get everybody out of here, because I know you guys have been very patient to sit around waiting for us for a while we went through SB 34. So I don't want this to be a waste of your time to finish this up. So go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just real quickly, you know, we're happy to continue these conversations for as long as you need us to. We do appreciate the fact that there are risks associated with the fund balance, whether we take this additional draw or not. And it is an important conversation. I would like to just highlight the fact that the governor's opinion is that this money that he's talking about repaying to the people is money that he doesn't feel should be in the fund at all. And so that conversation is one that I think is really important, which we can have at a later date. I'd also just highlight that there was a correction to, or there needs to be a correction to the bill for that number in fiscal year 22. They're in the bill now. It reads 1328. It should actually read 1388. We found that error.
Okay.
And thank Legislative Finance for identifying that for us.
Kathy. Senator Chickie, go ahead.
Just as a lead-in, for stress testing, and I don't expect an answer. I realize you didn't get there on this one, and I didn't expect you to. I mean, the reality of it is I'm just looking at how we pay the bills today and how I'm expecting that we pay the bills at the end of this session. So could I help by plugging in some assumptions for you to model so that you don't have to model a wide band? And someone sitting at that table knows how I think, so... He probably can make those assumptions on his own. But if you'd like to meet, I mean, I think we can model a few specific numbers and take a look at how that looks over time. I don't think we can assume what the legislature is going to do, and I'm very worried about that, which would create stress on the earnings reserve and potentially the corpus itself. So perhaps we can get together on that and give you some ideas that would streamline your work on modeling stress testing.
Be happy to.
Briefly, please. I don't want to keep them too long. Go ahead, Senator Rumble.
I have a 5 o'clock meeting too, but I think this is super important. I want to reiterate one more time, we need better granular data. These charts are not going to work for me, I can tell you that much. And for both with Senate Bill 23 and without, both of those charts need to be historic accurate, including the POMV, you know, what was happened, and now with the POMV, including the unstructured draw with Senate Bill 23, and an accurate projection and how you're modeling that projection of how these funds are going to work, because this is a very sensitive issue. The people are listening. It's paying back, of course, the populist view, just pay them all back and everyone wants their money. We can't get it wrong, you know, but however, it also has to be a permanent fund. And that's what the people for future generations. So this is something that is very, very difficult, and the people are probably watching this and the crime legislation more than anything else. So please provide us with good data.
Be happy to, Senator.
All right. So thanks again, gentlemen, for taking your time. So patient. I know it took a while to get there. We're going to bring you back, and we'll finish this up probably next week, but I'll let you know for sure. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for now. I'd like to remind everyone on the record, we're going to have public testimony for the PFD bills this Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. That'll be statewide, so we'll be hearing that. And we will do that several more times because we expect high interest in these bills. So we're going to make sure that the people have a chance to get their voice heard, and as Senator Ramble was talking about a moment ago. And then as well, so time for the committee members to chew on what changes you might want to see to those bills going forward. And at that point, I think that's enough. Concludes our business for the day. Senate State Affairs will meet again this Thursday, February 28, 2019, right back in this room. And we're going to go over the governor's appointee to the Department of Administration, Commissioner Designee Chewbacca. The committee will also be bringing back up SB 34 probation and parole sentences credits to consider those amendments. And if time allows, we'll get to, again, Senate Bills 23 and 24 as we did here. And we'll talk to you directly to make sure we're good. Seeing no other business before the committee, we're going to adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 5:00.